Welcome to Science in Africa, a Nature Careers podcast series. I'm Akin Jimo, Chief Editor of Nature Africa. I work and live in Lagos, and I'm passionate about promoting science and public health journalism in my native Nigeria and across Africa. In this series, we've been exploring the practice of science in this wonderful continent, the progress, the issues, the needs, and in the words of the African scientists who are based here. In this eighth and last episode, we look at science communication in Africa and hear about some creative solutions to promote science to the general public. Let's meet our researcher.
I'm Mary Bita. I am a mental health researcher based at the Kenya Medical Research Institute Welcome Trust Program in Kilifi, Kenya. And my research just develops and tests interventions that aim to address stigma in mental health in this setting. There are so many problems with mental health in Kenya. First of all, we do not even have a national survey, so we do not even know the precise burden of mental disorders in Kenya. And because of this, there are so many problems all the way from individual, interpersonal, community, organizational level. But one key problem that is cross-cutting is stigma. And stigma at all these levels, at all the levels that I've mentioned. And mainly, for example, at individual level, this comes because of cultural beliefs about the causes of these disorders. And some people think that mental health problems are caused by witchcraft, or by evil spirits, or by curses from parents or grandparents, whereas others think that some mental illnesses like depression are just a sign of laziness, or some people even believe that neurodevelopmental disorders like autism and attention deficit hyperactivity disorders, commonly called ADHD, are just defiant behavior from a child, whereas in fact most of these children really struggle to cope. And then this cascades up, goes all the way up to, for example, the policy level, where there are misconceptions about the low priority of mental health because of data. So they do not prioritize mental health. And what this leads to is lack of resource allocation to mental health. So, and then this again goes down to the community level and organizational levels, where now, for example, we don't have community mental health units in Kenya. We do not have drugs. We always have shortage of psychiatric drugs at the facility levels, just because of the lack of, you know, attention for mental health at the policy level. Interventions try to intervene at different levels. As you can hear, it's not possible to intervene at all the levels at any one time. But I think one of the key things is usually, one, to try and address stigma at individual, interpersonal, and community levels, and two, to just try and lobby at policy level so that across the different sectors or levels, the matter is taken up. In the last 5 years alone, we've had policy documents specifically for mental health. For example, there has been a national mental health policy and a national mental health action plan, and this has been developed and adopted at like national level and regional level. And then there's also been progress in like amending legislation. For example, there has been a recent lobby to decriminalize suicide, because as we speak, suicide is illegal in Kenya. Speaking of regionally, here in Kilifi, there's been tremendous progress, I guess, partly influenced by the presence of a research institute that's generating evidence. So compared to when I started working in Kilifi in 2015, there's been a lot of progress in every level of care. For example, they just recently formed Mental Health Technical Working Group, which now oversees all mental health activities. And then I think for me, the most promising venture here in Kilifi has been costing the Mental Health Action Plan, which means that money will be available for activities. And I think with that, things are looking up. Things will improve greatly. There are challenges that are common to like all fields of research, and then there are challenges that are unique to specific fields. And for me, interestingly, one of my biggest challenges is just language barrier. And I mean, you know, I conduct research in either Kiswahili or Kigiriama. So Kiswahili is Kenya's lingua franca, and then Kigiriama is the most widely spoken language here. And then I, you know, analyze and present my findings in English. Now, My method of working is participatory action research, which means that I involve the target populations in design, implementation, and evaluation of interventions. And so this demands that even communicating, I should communicate my results. Now, for many of my concepts, I do not have equivalent Kiswahili words or Kigiriama words to express this. And so although I try my best to make as good translations as possible, sometimes a lot of this is lost, so it becomes very difficult to communicate. I'll give you a recent example. I just concluded research on stigma, and then one of the outcomes I had was to measure changes in attitude as one of the many domains. And one of the subdomains I had was an attitude called authoritarianism. Now, I tried to translate this to Kiswahili as best as I could in a way that could be understood, and I'm still struggling with that. So that's just one of the things, just finding the right words to communicate the concepts without losing meaning. Another one around culture would be, the belief systems about some very critical components of our research, for example, samples. Here in the Kenya Medical Research Institute, there had been a long-standing suspicion in the community, particularly around collection of blood samples. So one of the key pieces of work that we do here is malaria research, which requires collection of blood samples at many intervals. And there was a time when there was a rumor going on in the community that the blood samples were being, like, there was this huge, so within our the Kemri logo, the organizational logo, there's a snake, which is usually common in many medical fields of research. And so there was this rumor that we are collecting blood to feed a certain, like, demon or something. And so they were suspicious about the number of times we were collecting blood and where we were taking this blood. And what happened is that a whole community engagement department had to be set up and run in the community to try and destigmatize these myths. And for a long time, and we still have people to date who believe that Cambry, the research institute, collects blood for demonic reasons. So there is that suspicion. And for a long time, even to date, we have international collaborators from all over the world. And so when, they see white people in the organization, and like myself, I'm from a different part of the country. I've come here and we are collecting these samples. There are those suspicions about, the culture and the belief around blood, and then suspicions about what some of these things are being used for because of lack of clarity or lack of understanding of scientific concepts. I'll give a recent example of a study where we had to collect saliva samples for a genetic study. Now, there's a lot of sacredness around saliva in this in the Kigiriama community, which is where I work. And there's also a lot of sacredness around genetics, which is, passing on information from one generation to another. So some of the challenges we had to we encountered is trying to demystify the myths that surround passing on genetic diseases, some of which mental disorders fall under. Psychiatric conditions like schizophrenia or psychosis, bipolar mood disorders, and even neurodevelopmental disorders, for which there is evidence that there is genetic links. And just explaining that we would be storing saliva samples for a long time because it has a very personal and a very spiritual meaning for some of the people here. So we really had a challenging time explaining this concept and gaining acceptance from the community. So those are just some of the, challenges that I experience in communicating this. Just the complexity even of the concepts of science itself. Yeah.
The lack of trust is rooted in local belief systems, religion, attitudes to science, and other issues around confidence in the authorities. Mary uses art and artistic performance to get around this.
I'll give an example from one of my projects called Difusimo, which is a Kigiriama word that means breaking free. So I use actually mainstream media and alternative media, social media. And I use art as a method of communication, specifically songs, dance, poems, and even short participatory videos and documentaries. Now, here in the local culture, in the Kigiriama culture, and I believe in many cultures across the continent, you know, music and dance have been used to preserve history, to explain phenomena, and even, most importantly, to pass very serious messages in very light moments. And the issue that I'm trying to tackle, which is stigma, is a very contentious one, particularly in the context of mental health, because of the cultural associations and beliefs. And so that's why I chose art, because one, it brings people together. And then in art, there's freedom of expression, which is very critical and which gives us an opportunity to address those really contentious issues. Tima tofauti kulingana na zile hali tuwapelekeni hospitali. So like when we have the mask campaigns at the community level, we actually get our artists to perform the songs, which are in most occasions formatted as question and answer. So the artist will sing a song asking the population a question, and then the population will give an answer. I'll give an example. You know, the artist will sing and ask, "What do you think causes depression?" as a song. And then maybe a member of the community will say, "I don't know, thinking too much or maybe stress or something." And then the artist will reply in song and say, "Would you like to come and dance with me to, you know, to demonstrate how you can like stop depression or be happy," or something like that. So it's usually very participatory and interactive. But within the song, there are messages about what causes these illnesses and what someone can do when they have these disorders. And we even sometimes communicate our findings, like, "Did you know that there is a cure for depression? Did you know that if you suffer from this, you can get help here and there?" All that is usually entailed in the songs. So we do. So what the design of, for example, Difusimu was such that we were working with people across all the levels, including like the administrators, etc. So when we have an event, we just usually advertise it through the administrators for the different like regions. And then we set a date and we send out the message, and then people just show up, people just come. And then, yeah, we perform and we share the messages. So we have some events inside, we have some events outside. Sometimes we attract, the pandemic brought challenges in terms of the number of people you could gather together. But pre-pandemic, it would be like in hundreds maybe at any one gathering. That's the whole point. Yes, it's we focus on the entertainment to attract the crowds, because we want people to, you know, we do not want the seriousness that's usually attached to, you know, research and health science. That will not attract the crowd. So we value the entertainment value of the songs, but we also ensure that, you know, once people are settled and the crowd is calm, we now engage in not only an entertaining way, but also, I call it, knowledge exchange, not just educating, because educating sounds like one way. We like engaging like in knowledge exchange, but we use the entertainment component to attract the crowds. The Difusimo program uses a concept we call participatory action research, which means that the target population or the stakeholders in whatever issue you're trying to address are involved in the conceptualization, development, implementation, and evaluation of the interventions. So in our case, the stakeholders are at the center of it are people with lived experience in mental illness and their caregivers. And then we also have healthcare providers, which could include biomedical healthcare providers, traditional healers, spiritual healers, and then we also have representatives from the administrative units, etc. And the idea is that concept development is shared. So in the case of Difusimo, it is people with lived experience and traditional healers and spiritual healers who suggested the use of songs and music and dance, essentially, as a tool or as a method of communicating. Because like I said, mental health is a very somber topic, I think, all over the world and even in this setting. And it is surrounded with a lot of myths and misconceptions. And so, you know, they suggested that to address this, we would use something that is light and where we'll be allowed to express ourselves, because, you know, music allows, you know, jokes and, you know, etc. So that is how we chose music and dance as a method of communicating, discussing stigma in mental health, essentially.
Asante, asante, asante sana DJ. Asante sana kila mtu ambaye uko hapa. Sasa nafikiri tume.
A lot of our work is audiovisual. And so we also rely on, you know, pictures and videos and music to disseminate the information, because when we go for like community outreaches, we usually film, you know, some of the stories that we collect in the field. And so one prominent work that we did was a documentary called The Man in Chains, which was about a person who had lived with schizophrenia for 25 years. And the community believed that this person possessed supernatural powers, and so he never sought any form of treatment for his illness, and he deteriorated, and he started wandering away and getting lost, and then they would chain him to a tree in his homestead.
Bang.
And that's how we coined the name Man in Chains. And so we've used this documentary to speak about stigma around mental illness, beliefs and myths and misconceptions about the causes of mental illness. And I think it has always been very emotive, but we've in most circumstances received overwhelmingly positive reception, and people have opened up about, for example, people that they're hiding at home because of stigma. And they've really expressed gratitude for showing that film, because they've seen avenues which they can help their own people back at home. Yeah. So, yeah, so we use documentaries. We've posted them on our website and our social media platforms. But when we go to the field, we actually carry filming and screening equipment. So we will carry the projector, a laptop, a white screen, speakers and everything. And we'll select a venue with access to electricity. And we plug in our equipment and show the population. So with the radio events, what we usually do is just we book slots for just discussing mental health, and it's usually advertised on the radio pages, the web pages and everything. And then mostly it's usually around prime time, so maybe 8 in the morning or 8 p.m. So, yeah, we'll just get people listening in and calling in live to ask questions, and sometimes to challenge some of the things that we've said. And then we usually just answer and have discussions, usually moderated by like the radio presenter for that particular show. Yeah, we have had metrics where we've attracted 1 million listeners. And remember, with the radio shows, it's not regional. It's people are listening from different parts of the country. So we have had large listenerships for some of the programs, as high as 1 million people. Yeah.
I'm personally very interested in Mary Bita's innovative strategy to improve the care of mental health patients in Kenya. As a science communicator in Nigeria, I well understand the challenges of trying to overcome cultural barriers and the multifaceted approach you need to overcome them. In 2013, I undertook a task for UNICEF Nigeria to increase vaccine uptake in children. The Muslim population of northern Nigeria became suspicious of an immunization program. Polio, measles, diphtheria, and other childhood immunizable diseases. They began to believe misinformation that the vaccines affected fertility. We launched various myth-busting campaigns about how vaccines are developed and manufactured. We engaged community and religious leaders, recruited thousands of volunteers to knock on people's doors, and organized national vaccination days. We used all forms of media, newspapers, radio, television, and community theater to educate the public. And it worked. In 2020, Nigeria, the last polio endemic country in Africa, was officially certified free from polio after marking 3 consecutive years since the last case of wild polio was reported. Mary Bita came up against a similar wall of misconceptions, but used a different approach, participatory action research, in order to educate. Did it work?
The quantitative results of our analysis are showing that it's working. Yes, we are seeing an improvement in levels of knowledge, in changes in attitude, and improvements in reported and intended behaviors. But of course, what we are observing so far is in the short term. So we are yet to see whether these effects will be sustained in the long term. But again, just to say that our campaigns have been very targeted. We have the campaigns that we've evaluated empirically have been very targeted to specific groups. So again, you know, you're asking a very difficult question about whether this works for large mass populations. That is something that we are yet to see. But just to say, I'm sure everyone appreciates that change takes time. We're asking people to change their long-held beliefs and attitudes and behavior. That is something we have to wait and see. For me, one big outcome of this work is that we are opening avenues for dialogue. I think for me, that's a big change because mental health stigma has been a taboo subject for the longest time. And so just the fact that there are these avenues for dialogue, for me, is evidence that we are one step in the right direction. As long as it's contextually relevant, the idea of participatory action research is long overdue because when you use participatory approaches, you actually address what matters the most to that target population, which varies from population to population. And then also there's a problem researchers refer to as type 3 error, which essentially means challenges with problem conceptualization. But if you use participatory action research, you actually conceptualize the problem correctly. For instance, in most cases, mental health is conceptualized biomedically, which means that people think of schizophrenia, depression, those categorical, you know, categorization of mental illness. But that's what we've learned for Difusimo is that that's not how people understand mental health in this setting. Some people actually understand it as a blessing in disguise in the instances where they believe someone possesses supernatural powers, whereas a doctor would call those hallucinations and delusions. So I think they are sustainable if they're locally adapted. And if they are participatory, so that when you're addressing a problem, you address what matters most to the population you're targeting. Yeah.
Misinformation about science, whether it's mental health or immunization programs, is a global challenge, not just Africa's. The recent divided opinions about COVID vaccines is a case in point. Good science communication is critical to preserving and improving the health of society. Thankfully, there are positive stories like Mary Bitters, but much more needs to be done. Well, that's all for this episode and the series, Science in Africa, a Nature Careers podcast. I'm Akin Jimo, Chief Editor of Nature Africa. I hope you've enjoyed the journey. Thank you for listening.